Okay, howdy.
Hi, I'm Scott Jones. I'm the director of the Electronic Truck Years Forms track at Dragon Con. This year, our designated charity is Special Olympics of Georgia. If you have some spare change, you could throw in a dollar or two. We'd really appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and send this around and come back and pick it up in a minute. So thank you very much. Also, please feel free to rate the app. I don't want to make this a technical challenge, but we do enjoy those good ratings.
At this point, bills would be better than change. That thing's getting really heavy.
We need fives to balance it out today.
There you go, fives.
I need a couple of volunteers. The way we do the money count, this is how we keep everything honest and assure you that your money is going where it should be. We have several people count the money out at once, we take pictures, record the thing. We'll go over here in the corner so you can count it out. We get the panel started. Everyone agree on the total, give us a total, and we bring you receipts when it's all done. This way, no shady things going on with the money. We've been doing this for 20 years and never had an incident. So feel free to take pictures, feel free to record it, feel free to post totals online. Lace back around again, please. Thank you.
By the way, I just Facebooked this. I just got into the elevator and it was empty. It must be Sunday.
Everybody's party.
At least it wasn't got into an elevator.
All right, it's time. Welcome to Hacking 201. Woo! Everyone having a good time?
Yeah.
All right, so fun panel. You ask us questions, we give you answers that may or may not be true, and hopefully we'll all learn something before it's over and done with, and then we go grab shitloads of pizza and break up into a bunch of different groups talking about whatever and playing with technology and having fun. And you want to talk about Network King of the Hill a little bit, perhaps?
Yeah, support.
Yeah, come on up here. We're going to explain this because this is a really freaking amazing tool, and it's free and open source.
I like open source.
And don't stand right in front of the speaker there because you do not want
the speaker.
So, hey, everybody, you guys enjoying DragonCon so far?
Yeah!
Well, we just asked that.
All right, cool. I hope you are. This is Net King of the Hill. This is Net King of the Hill. Thank you. It is an awesome platform for running King of the Hill style competitions. If you don't know what a King of the Hill style competition is, it is basically, if you've ever played any kind of King of the Hill game, type in a video game, or if you can remember classic, Capture Flag is another good example, but it's more about the length of time you hold a point. And it's the same thing here. There's a couple machines on our network, and they're all vulnerable to something. You hack in, you put your team tag, which is, if you're familiar with HTML, it's just team between less than greater than, whatever the hell you want to call yourself, then close the tag. You put that on the index web page of whatever the site is on the box that you have, and the longer your tag is there, the more points you get. This was originally developed by Iron Geek. It's really awesome. We host this a lot at both the 2600 meeting and DC404 here in Atlanta. It's like a background event while the meetings are going on, and it's a lot of fun. Highly suggest it. So if you play this and you enjoy it, I would suggest going to the meeting so you can continue to play. If you want to host your own, this is open source. Go to netcoff.github.io. It's there, and it's awesome. So yeah, if you want to play today, our network is, the SSID is netcoff, the password is DC404DC404, and the scoreboard is on 192.168.101.2. And so you hop on, and every machine that you see there is a target machine. Read the rules, and have fun.
You'll probably see this popping up in more and more user groups and conventions. We're going to start making it a regular part of the Nashville Linux Users Group, which I run up in Nashville, Tennessee. Viva Nash Vegas, eat more rhinestones. And because it is free and open source, people develop all sorts of stuff. There was a recent update that was posted to the DC404 list.
So the whole reason I'm even here is Scott invited me up because I made an update of Net King of the Hill called Propane. and you can make propane accessories for it. It's really cool. It's basically just met King of the Hill, but it's got a few new flashy things. So if you're interested in that, you can find that on GitHub as well by just searching propane cough, and it's there. It's pretty cool. So.
I've gotten the Chattanooga Linux users group interested in this. They're called Chuggler, which is a fantastic name, and they do a lot of ham radio stuff, so I think they're going to spread it more and start adding wireless devices and even some ham radio interfaces, and they're going to really get out. The guy who has been doing a lot of the recent work on, he didn't write the thing from scratch, but he's done a lot of development on, is a gentleman at Georgia Tech named Keith Watson. He was assistant director on the EFF track for many years. Part of his day job is taking botnets away from organized crime outfits. He's a pretty cool guy, and Georgia Tech has loved this thing. They contribute a lot of code to it. So, again, a fun, amazing tool. Okay, enough selling you on something free that you can download. We'll have all the links for it on eff.blackandcon.org if you're interested. And I'm going to let the panelists introduce themselves. And unlike Hacking 101, when we start at the far end table and work down, we'll start at the near end of the table.
No, that makes me first again. No.
You can pass on your turn.
I'm not passing it. Okay, I'm Randall Schwartz, probably best known for my contribution to the series of Perl books. Yeah, that's what I thought. It's not loud. Series of Perl books. Camel Book, Llama Book, the Alpaca Book, those were all mine. And my team also wrote Mastering Perl, which is the Tycoonian or something like that. And then I ran the number one Perl training company during the late 90s while the dot-com boom was exploding. And some have argued that my books helped create the interactive web. And I would actually support that. I then went on to do trainings on cruise ships. So I've been on 80 cruises in the last 17 years. That's been really, really awesome, 640 CAs. I've been doing another little thing. Maybe many of you might know me from this, Floss Weekly, my podcast. Anybody hear of Floss Weekly? Yeah, number one open source podcast. Check it out. We've been doing this for 10 years, and we've had some of the most amazing guests on. And what's great is that every week I get to talk to somebody cool. You know, that's great about a weekly podcast, is you get to talk to cool people. And like I said, we're getting about 50,000 downloads, so it's the number one open source podcast. So that's making me famous as well, which is nice. I don't mind fame, because fame can sometimes be converted into cash. So that's kind of nice. I wasn't here last year. Did I phone in on 101 or 201?
It's a blur.
201, okay. So this panel last year. You know, make it louder. I'm an inch away. All right. So, I was actually in the hospital last year. I had a some sort of seizure related to bad food. It's basically the way I say it. I bought a sandwich at a Quickie Mart, and 2 days later, I was in the hospital. So, and I have a six-figure medical bill now, which I'm slowly working off.
You need to write more books.
I'm going to need to write more things, whatever it is. Yes, exactly. But I'm very happy to be back here again. This is great. It's my 13th out of 15 years. Woo!
Just to give you an example of how damn good his books are, you can tell how good or how successful someone or something is by how often it's pirated, and people pirate the shit out of everything he wrote.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to pause for just a second because we've got a crypto challenge award winner. So yes, I'm just going to.
Here, there. You can explain it better than me.
So, you may have heard this. This year we did our third annual crypto challenge. We actually had 50 teams. Competing this year. We actually had a hard and or beginner and advanced level. We had we had first place in the beginner level. If you're here, Power of Friendship got all 10 right. Come up here, I got your prize.
Is that pizza?
It is. So they got 95 points out of 100. They got basically 9 out of 10 without any clues, and they got the last one with a clue.
Wow.
But there were full competitions. There were six teams right there behind them, getting 9, 8 out of 10. They just needed that last extra one. In hard level, this was a little more difficult. The point scores there were, in the winning team is Crypto Knights with 55 points. They actually received 3 out of 10 without any clues, and it was pretty hard. So if anybody here from Crypto Knights, oh, here you are. There you go. And the close second was LOL Electronics. Came close, but not quite there. If anybody has questions about some of the puzzles and wants to know how it came up with them and stuff like that, I'll be in back answering questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Woo! Congratulations to all the winners. For everyone who entered, congratulations to you. Sorry you didn't get the big prize. Hopefully you learned stuff and come back next year and keep playing. All right, let's continue with the introductions, please.
All right, hi, I'm David. I'm a software security consultant for a company called Synopsys, support me signal. I do a lot of pen testing, web app pen testing.
Can you turn it up?
Hello? Testing.
Let's just crank the ring volume up. Check.
Swallow the mic. Hello. All right, hi, I'm David. I'm a software security consultant at a company called Citadel, Citadel, now Synopsys, we recently acquired. I do a lot of pen testing from web apps, mobile apps, networks, red teaming, light, reverse engineering, a bunch of stuff. I started a lot more recently than all of these guys, so maybe I can give some context of starting in 2017.
I probably have code over the
game. Yes, definitely. I wrote books before you were born.
So hello.
That's very loud.
All right.
My name is Jay Freeman, but everyone online knows me as Sork. If you've heard of jailbreaking the iPhone, I run Cydia, the alternative to the App Store. So all jailbroken phones run my software, but I typically do not work on the actual exploit for iOS. I do everything that occurs after the hack. I was involved in a couple of them, but I did do some exploits for Android, which I almost describe as the amateur bracket of hacking. My background in networking, I pioneered some features of the NMAP port scanner, such as its ability to determine what program and what version of the program is running on the remote side instead of that specific just what port. I wrote the first decompiler for .NET, which ended up being used by Microsoft to do a test case with some of their compilers. And I also, what I'm currently most well known as far as like techniques is runtime code modification. I developed Substrate, which is the library and framework that's used on iOS in order to inject into and modify running programs and add functionality and behaviors after the fact, as well as Script, which is a hybrid of JavaScript, Objective-C, and now Java. That allows you to inject a console into a running program and then replace out native parts of it with JavaScript. So I'm happy to answer any questions about reverse engineering or static analysis, network protocols, exploitation work, etc.
And we're going to have a live demonstration of jailbreaking a phone, and I have graciously volunteered my phone to be jailbroken. So
it's like running Android 2.3.5 from like 5 years ago.
I think they can still break it.
I can't download the DragonCon app, so since they didn't put the fucking PDF online before I throw down, I had no idea what the schedule was until I got on the site.
My name is Ray Kelly, and I work for HP Enterprise, or I did as of Friday until they spun us all their software off to a company called Microfocus. But I'll just say we're HP still. So I work in a, we got acquired, I worked for a company called Spy Dynamics, who wrote an application called WebInspect. So it was an app that I was the lead developer on it, and you would point it at a website, it would go hack your website for you. So it could show you the vulnerabilities before the bad guys do. So that was kind of my main thing. Went on to some other startups. One was called PureWire, where we did cloud-based filtering. That got acquired by Barracuda. Went back to HP to run their mobile pen testing team. So spent 2 years doing mobile pen tests. So my thing is pretty much web application security.
So my name is Matt Blaze. My day job is as a professor in the computer science department at University of Pennsylvania in Philly. And I've been active in the community as a hacker probably since professionally and working in computer security and cryptography around 1994 or so. And I've done a number of things. I've done flaws in the system called the Clipper chip that the U.S. government had, and asked your parents about it. And found some flaws in wiretapping systems. And although I'm in sort of normal life, I spend a lot of time on internet protocols and internet type software systems. I'm actually more interested in vulnerabilities and things other than stuff connected to the internet. And, so I guess that's the perspective that I have.
All right, thank you. I'm Johnny X. I am your moderator. At various points, I have been the Space and Science Track Director, the Space Track Director, the Science Track Director. I helped start the EFF track. I helped start the Skeptics track. I've started several hacker conventions or been a co-organizer. I've also disowned a couple. I've worked for Google. I'm currently looking, and I consider, I do a lot of routing and switching stuff, and I consider myself more of a social engineering person than a hardcore tech person, because I get into all sorts of crazy places and do all sorts of shit that I shouldn't be allowed to do. Thank you very much, Tony, for that. I appreciate it. So we should probably have a floor mic or something up here, because I really don't want to run around the room to people who raise their hands. So,
do we bring a box?
I don't know. We got a floor stand anywhere? We probably should have asked you about that. I am so sorry. A mic stand. Okay, I'll be human mic stand.
He's rolling his eyes.
He's rolling his eyes.
Sunday night,
he was rolling his eyes.
I'll be right back.
All right, I'll stand here.
Yeah. We'll wait here.
So we'll just rip. Let's just get rid of it.
I'll stand here with my shot of something for when the audio stuff.
Secret equipment room back there. What else is back there?
I don't know. As soon as we get the mic stand up here, I'm going to go back there and see. So, first question, come on up. If you have questions, line up. That's how we do it. Anything goes. Any questions, comments, criticisms, requests, death threats. Come on. That's my radio station days.
We're not that entertaining until you ask us.
I'm kind of tired. Can I be electrocuted?
But of course.
No!
He just
doesn't react.
What?
And, he's a human.
I've got fresh batteries in the thing too, but I mean,
use Randall as a controller.
No!
You have to request being prodded. Otherwise, it's felonious assault.
Yeah.
Into that.
I am not into that. No.
Yes, sir.
There's other things I'm well into, but not.
Hi.
Did I say that loud? Okay.
Yes, sir. Oh, my goodness. So I'm kind of new to IT in that I'm studying for my APS, I'm studying networking, I'm still on OSI, so you guys are like gods to me.
Everyone started somewhere, so.
Yeah. My question is, how outside of tech did getting into this field affect you? Like, how did you, like you said, you are interested in vulnerabilities outside of technology. How did this like affect the way that you navigate through the world?
I think you often look at where are the edges to things. Well, I do, so that's probably why it's more interesting for me. So I'm often looking at where are the edges. So here's the rule, where are the edges to the rule? What's the thing I can hack about that? And that's not just in IT, it's not just in technology, it applies everywhere. In Hacking 101, I gave a story of hacking a menu, to be able to get exactly the drink I want, instead of having to pay for double price, because it's half price for happy hour for the thing. Go back and listen to the 101 panel, you're here. But I'm always trying to figure out, okay, what can I ask or do or say? My favorite example of this, again, not the menu example this time, but I took a class on finances, and the one of the things they said is, always ask for the discount. And I thought, I should try that. So I went into Kinko's the next day and I had a production run I had to do. And then I asked the barely college age guy behind the counter, I said, what about the discount? He looks at me and goes, what discount? And I go, a discount. And he pulls the manager over. The manager pulls up this calculator and takes like 15% off. Ask. That's the worst that'll happen. They'll say, no, you don't get a discount.
Is this a property of your life that came from being in this field or from entering this field, or is this what brought you to this field?
Well, you know, I think it's because, well, but I've been in this field since I was like 9, so it's kind of, that's kind of hard to say before the field. But, you know, then being interested in computer security, I sort of kept exploring edges everywhere.
So I think one thing, if I can just add to that, you know, there's one kind of generational gap up here. You know, the elderly folks, like at the two ends of this table, you know, we got into this field before it was a field, right? So we kind of fell into it. And I think, you know, everybody kind of has their own origin story of what got them into it. For me, it was, you know, basically I didn't have a lot of resources. I didn't have, you know, I wasn't going to a university that was studying this and studying this that had all sorts of computers and things. At the time, I was getting interested in this. So I had to really fight my way for access to the technology that I wanted to play with. And that meant trying to figure out how to get things to do stuff that they weren't intended to do in order for me to be able to play with them. And, you know, along the way, I ended up discovering, oh, I'm doing computer security. That's kind of a thing. And, you know, now people kind of start, can start and say, oh, okay, there are role models, there's a career path, there are things to do, I want to learn how to do those things. So in some sense, you know, you can say that the current generation of people have it both easier and harder. They have it easier because there are at least things to emulate, but they have it harder because, you know, a lot of the low-hanging fruit and a lot of the paths to learn this where you can convert your passion into it have been kind of well tread. So I think there may be a generational issue in answering that question.
I think you'll have to be careful, though, when you say emulate. So in my particular history, many of you didn't hear and know it because I've talked about it many years here, is that I pissed off Intel, and I became a triple felon for it. And so part of what you should do is read any of the chapters in 26 books now, I think, with my last count, that talk about my case, or go to my Wikipedia page and go, don't emulate that.
Yeah.
You should also
mention, this is being recorded, don't admit any crimes.
Yeah. Save that for when we're in the other room and we're no longer recording. Real briefly, to add something to what you said about just, you know, ask for the discount, that's kind of social engineering. Cops and lawyers are really good at. They ask for things which they are not entitled and which you are under no obligation to give them all the time. And if you just ask the right way, like the person you're talking to is supposed to give you whatever it is, it's amazing how many times they hand over things that they really shouldn't. This young lady has been waiting quite patiently, so thank you very much.
I completely understand. One, it's that asking, just making sure that you actually get every discount that you could be there, that's a lifestyle. That's not something that's taught. I think that's just kind of, okay, you know, let's see what I can do. Because, you know, I may or may not have got into tomorrow role, like behind the scenes. Weren't you with the press? Yeah. Two, as far as getting into hacking, getting into just computer security, IT security, anything like that, now I think I get kind of jealous, you know, in the 90s and that time, computers were horribly insecure. And in my head, I'm like, wow, I was doing, you know, I was on real beds at the time, but, you know, I could kind of see some of the stuff that you guys were exploiting. And I'm jealous because it was so much easier back then. However, the time when I look at it, it's like, it can still be done. You just have to work a little bit harder. And it's the challenge that kind of gets me.
I think, though, that in the 90s, there weren't as many computers, and the attack vector wasn't, the surface vector was not as big. Now, I mean, once we put Windows desktops on every person's machine, now we have a huge attack vector.
Exactly.
Don't run Windows. Just don't.
The Internet of Things is making it very easy to get into stuff. So.
I can do it for you. My question was, you know, I've studied a lot of the, you know, security and networking. I do a lot of vulnerability scanning in my job and a lot of setting baselines and stuff like that. However, I've been doing this kind of for my entire life under the radar, but how can you get into social engineering? That's like, how do you do something like that for a lifestyle professionally? Yeah.
That would be, I guess, and I wish she was here, a panelist we had last year, she just couldn't make it for financial reasons. Scott will have her information, but she listened to the Hacking 101 and 201 talks last year, and she talks about red team physical penetration, and a lot of that involves social engineering. Red teams are like the offensive teams, physical penetration is getting into buildings and places, right. That involves a lot of social engineering.
I was there last year.
Oh, okay. Listen to those talks. And if you're, are you local? Are you in? If you're not already on the DEFCON 404 mailing list, get on the mailing list. The Atlanta 2600 mailing list is good too. Start going to meetings, start talking to people, network with other people who are similar. And if you have a comment, come up and say it into the microphone so we can get it recorded.
They're hosting the hackers, can't remember the exact who mentioned, but their convention in Atlanta in October. And since you're a woman, you can go free. They've given IBM scholarships to all women to go.
This is what we do, is we get people talking to each other here.
They're having Red Blue marathons. I'll get it, and I'll announce it so all the women can sign up for it.
Yeah, and get the information also to Scott. He's the EFF track director, EFF@DragonCon.org, and he can put it as an update on the EFF.DragonCon.org website.
So I assume they're going to check your ID if you're a woman, but you could try it as a man, too. You know, they
might social engineering.
I would also, I would follow that up with, back about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I started studying this thing called neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, Rittner and Bandler's books. There's such an amazing wealth of things, particularly in the book Transformations, where they talk about how if you reach out to make a handshake with somebody, and then you pull it away before they finish the handshake, they're actually stunned for 2 to 3 seconds. At that point, you can say almost anything, and it goes straight past the filters. It's pretty amazing what they figured out with their work in neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. Check it out.
We should practice
that. Awesome. I don't know if this is an inappropriate question to ask at 201, and this is the creepy stuff, but what skills, right now I'm trying to move from the department I'm in into systems. I'm trying to stack my skills and also get certification as well. What primary skills, like top three skills you think I should have in order to make it? My ideal job description would be security analyst, because I'm trying to go for. So what top three skills do you think I should have?
Well, really, what would you be happy doing all day? That's the real question. Never pick a job that's not about you being happy all day. I've reinvented my career 6 times already because I've kept saying, no, I don't want to do this anymore, I want to do this. Pick the things that will make you happy.
I like to add to that too, absolutely. So pick an area you like. I like developing, I like coding. So I get in that area, like I said, web application security. You know, there's networking security, there's social engineering, there's many aspects. Find what you enjoy and try a little bit of all of it. You know, I hate networking. It's stupid. but I love coding and I love breaking code, other people's code, and that is just enjoyable to me. So find what you like first and then dive in into that area.
Yeah, along with that, for us, when we hire people, generally the key thing we look for is something called being creatively malicious. You want to be able to have a mindset going into something where it's like. You want to go into something and you want to say, like, if someone asks you, how would you break this, you should be able to come up with an idea that's pretty realistic, but also creative. in how you approach something like that.
Are you training and or hiring?
Talk to you afterwards.
So something that I would say, you asked for some skills, and I would mention that generally having understanding of how compilers work would be really helpful to get an understanding of how to attack native code, and getting an understanding of some common web frameworks. But the question that you were kind of driving at that a lot of us up here answering of how do you get into this sort of thing if you see it and you're kind of excited about it, but you're not certain how to make it your skill or your life. The recommendation that I would give is possibly the same way that you might get into being a magician. So there's like a skill of trying to trick somebody into thinking that you're doing one thing, you're actually doing something else, or that you're, in this case, you're trying to get a computer program to do something, and you're trying to hide information from it at various points. A lot of these things that are coming down to like little tricks of the trade that people, once they're real magicians, are coming up with. Like when you hear about a great magician, they're not doing the same trick you've heard of hundreds of thousands of times before. But you don't seem to start getting magic by doing that. You get to start getting the magic because when you were a kid, you were told how to do a little trick, and you do it for your parents, and you do it for your friends, and you kind of trick them with that thing, and then you start getting an understanding of those processes. I didn't get into doing computer program like the really complicated parts of it, of doing return-oriented programming or trying to do buffer overflow attacks or anything, just de novo from nowhere. I started by seeing existing attacks, learning what the vulnerability was, and then reading the code for it, and then learning about existing attacks and trying to write my own implementation of that attack. And then hearing about different classes of attack, kind of stretching my skill to the point where I had this buildup in my mind of all of these different techniques that people generally can utilize. And then when I see something new, I'm able to look at it and go, well, what kinds of mistakes are here that I've often seen before? And sometimes I find a new kind of mistake. But I don't think it just comes out of like, just you know all the skills. It kind of becomes like a practice of seeing the thought process. And the practice of the thought process isn't you learn how to do low-level software development and you learn about web frameworks and you do this. It's like getting into the culture of hacking and seeing it.
Yeah,
just to add to that, programming is both a science and an art. The science in the sense of, you know, red plus yellow equals orange. But there's the art of having seen so many solutions and then being able to twist it a little, move it forward, standing on the shoulders of giants ahead of you. And that's where the skill comes.
So I teach in a university for a living, and I get that very question from like our undergrads and grad students, how do I get into this? And you know, there are two parts to this. But one is the sort of artistry part, and you know, how do you get the attitude? And you get the attitude by studying how things have happened and trying to emulate them, and by, you know, maybe ideally, you know, get under the wing of somebody who knows this. But you also kind of want the foundations. And the foundations are particularly the computing systems foundations. Like, if you're in college, you really want to be taking the operating systems class. You really want to be taking the compilers class. If you're not, you want to be a computer architecture as well. If not, you know, you want to get the equivalent knowledge and experience and have those things at your fingertips. Really understanding how a program runs on a computer from the hardware and the instructions all the way up to the actual interaction that it's doing, that's probably the central kind of foundational skill that we all share. Then on top of that, it's developing the attitude. I love the term creative malice that you've come up with, but you also kind of need both that and the foundational stuff.
And I really want to back up Matt on that, because I know sometimes people hear like, oh, you need to learn these foundations. They're like, no, I dropped out of college, I don't think I should finish that thing. And so I think you top out in your ability to get some things done. When you start doing super advanced reverse engineering, there is a lot of math in that. And I really love having had the math background of going through and taking advanced math courses when I was in college and in some of the grad school work that I did. If you have it, it's okay if you didn't do that in college, you can still do that now. But don't just think, oh, you know, all of this like academia parts are not interesting. They really are foundations, as he has the term of the work we do.
Last quick comment: find friendly communities, online communities. If it's mailing lists, websites, meetups, and if you can find physical meetings, go to them and network with people and just ask questions, experiment, play. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. You learn more from your mistakes than your successes. if you try out a community and people there are assholes, hey, it's 2015. There are a zillion online communities now. It's not like
that. It's 2017.
Okay, we're in the 21st century. It's not like the 1980s or 90s where there are a few limited communities. You've got a zillion places to go. If you run into assholes, go somewhere else. There's friendly people who want to teach and share knowledge everywhere. Next question. Thank you, sir. Thank you, all of you, for your patience. Let's try to keep the answers a little bit.
Forgive me if this is a little rambling, but during the last year, I've had experiences, or at least exposure to the Internet of Things, when I got to update my kitchen and was offered smart refrigerators, smart ovens, smart microwaves, smart thermostat, which I didn't get any of. But I would like to get your opinion on the vulnerability and why they even think it needs to have internet connectivity on any of these appliances, and why it would possibly outweigh the benefits of, you know, the not having it. The other question I have for you is, I'm actually a mechanic by trade, and I've been updating software on many computers in the 15 and 16s, and with new Bluetooth that they have built into the calls for the automatic service reminders and stuff like that, doesn't that open up a new port of attack for getting into the physical access?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yeah, and we're all going to die.
People weirdly like that the convenience or argument of having network connected devices. I mean, if you have the people seem to like having an Alexa listening to them constantly and then trying to figure out what they're saying and ask the questions. Whereas I walk the room, I see an Alexa, and I just get terrified.
Hey, Wiretap, what's the lyrics to my favorite song?
An example of one where a concrete one that people seem to really think is a great idea is network attached door locks, so that you can temporarily hand access to somebody and then revoke it easily. Like, you're only able to get into my house for the next 2 hours, so I really need you to get in there, and I can revoke that. But of course, once you have a network attached door lock and they're all the same door lock and there's a vulnerability in it, now you can just unlock every door at once, whereas at least there was some time you had to spend in order to pick each individual lock that you would do the lock pick, right? I'm a member of a group called Exploiteers, somewhat adjunct, but they always put their name on their slides, which is sometimes awkward, which at DEF CON every year does a talk on hacking large numbers of Internet of Things devices, and they're ludicrously insecure. And they are actually kind of a fun way to get into some of this stuff, because they typically are like a one-off stupid device built by somebody who has no idea about security.
A lot of these things, the firmware never gets upgraded because they figure they're going to sell you the next physical update, so why bother to update the firmware, and then you have shit sitting out there for years that's... I hate the Internet of Things.
The problem with that is, what application was it that recently they did an update and then locked everybody out? Smart lock somewhere got updated and it locked everybody out.
I kind of like the Samsung smart TVs where they forced a firmware updating that breaks these $2,000 TVs.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing I found out, a lot of these items now, the physical items are shipping before the firmware has even been written or figured out. They just stick a bootloader in there. So when you start it up, it immediately demands an internet connection to actually download the firmware to make it work, because they're on such a tight schedule to get it out to market. Don't bother to write the code first. They just ship you the shit and think, pick up the internet and we'll send you the software when it's ready, maybe.
And I'll add too, about a year ago, I was fooling around, like, I want to write my own IoT scanner. I want to look for IoT devices on networks. And, like, everyone's doing that now. But I was fooling with it a couple years ago. And just testing out in my house, I ran it. So I scanned my whole IP range in my house. And the server shows up. And I said, there's no server there. I know what's on my network. There is nothing there. And I could not figure out what the hell was responding. And so I took the IP address and I dropped it in a browser, who knows, maybe it's a web interface. And sure enough, it was. A page came up that had like Pandora settings and Spotify settings. I'm still thinking, what the hell is this thing? I don't have anything. What it ended up being was my Onkyo receiver. I had to plug it into the network for firmware updates. Well, it was also hosting its own web server embedded inside of it, and I had no clue it has been plugged in for a year. Who knows the last time that thing got updated? So things that you don't even know that are IoT is kind of shocking too.
And then a lot of these devices have ludicrously insecure firmware update mechanisms, but in addition to having a bunch of sensors attached to your network, and so now you can even remotely update the firmware, even if you just like local access for a couple seconds, you can change all the software running on it, and who will ever figure out or notice the fact that you're now listening to them?
This is not what we had in mind as the internet back in the 80s and 90s when we were creating this shit. I don't know when we lost control, but this was not what we had in mind.
We have achieved peak internet. It was like 3 years ago. 3 years ago.
Sorry about the rant. Go.
No, by all means. Matt, I just want to make sure, is this the same Matt Blaze that has written the extraordinarily nice books about how radios of all types, including ham radios, can be used in all types of emergencies?
No.
Same collision.
How did you not say yes? You could have spewed out all sorts of crazy bullshit.
Yeah, I do radio stuff, but I never wrote that book.
Okay, must be from that place. My apologies. Second, just quick question. Do I have any of your objections to tapping into the power outlets over here?
Not my hotel, I don't give a shit.
Awesome!
Not my circus, not my monkey.
If you electrocute yourself,
please stay dead.
Yeah,
use a radio.
I recently left Apple Corporate. I was a professional trainer for 5 years. The thing here is that I never actually learned anything about code. I have a liberal arts degree, so I have no real formal education in terms of that. And so it's really been this thing of self-taught study. And I recently had a job interview, and it was just 2 hours of straight logic games. I have never been under anything like that in my life. And I was wondering if just being that y'all are kind of the leaders in the tech industry, what are you assessing for exactly? How do you feel about that? Like my response, it was a man in the middle attack. They're like, oh, it has a lock, you send it to them, and then you can send it. I was like, oh, there's an app for that. You can just scan the key and then have a locksmith make the key in the other country. There is actually an app for that. And they were like, what? So I was just wondering, like, how y'all feel about that? Any advice on tech interviews, especially since I'm branching out just from strictly Apple to try and embrace everything?
I'm
not a tech leader or coder, so.
I'll speak to that a little bit. Because I send my students off to these companies where they do these awful tech interviews, and I think one thing everyone seems to agree on is the Silicon Valley style tech interview is like this incredibly broken process that tests for skills that are only tangentially relevant, and one of the problems is that that's excluding people who are can really do badly on that interview process, but have very promising careers ahead of them. And so, it's very, I share your pain about how awful some of this is. That said, that's starting to change. The Google interview of 5 years ago was very different from the Google interview today. I think that's also becoming true of big companies like Apple and Amazon and so on. But, I think that cracking that interview process is, that's a real problem on both the interviewee side and the interviewer side.
I think the most important thing to do is, how many people here are familiar with thedailywtf.com? Got a few. Go check it out. Thedailywtf.com. This is tales of tech horror every day. And about at least once a week, they talk about a terrible tech interview. And the reason I'm going to point you at that site is for you to recognize when you're being led down a path that's not going to be useful in the tech interview. But again, back to the person's question. Did you go away?
You went back.
Oh, I went back. Okay. So the point is, why are you moving from liberal arts to tech? What do you like about tech? And if you're not like studying that in your entire alpha hours, you're not going to ace a tech interview. That's just how simple it is. So please, you know, spend every off hour you have learning the thing you want to get to. And if you don't find that that is fun, stop doing it, please. We have way too many programmers that don't belong as programmers. Thank you.
I'll give you my two cents real quick on how I aced my Google interview, which is nothing like the horror stories I heard about. And this was in 2004 when they were still privately held before they went public, and I apparently beat out 3,000 other people for this job. And I'm sure I was not the most qualified person for the job, but I made sure my resume had no spelling mistakes in it, and it was very neat. I showed up for the interview in a suit, and I was wearing one of the geekiest ties you can imagine. It had computers all over it and Tabasco sauce bottles. I was sitting reading the latest issue of Linux Journal in the interview room where all the other people were waiting, and when they called me to interview and I flipped my bag open and put my bag in, I accidentally dropped the motherboard tester and power supply tester out of my bag. I was like, oh, excuse me, let me put those back in. And the interviewer, there were three people for the interview. The interviewer asked me like three bozo questions based on my last job, like what's in the HTTPB conf file, something about hard drives and something about RAM. And that was it, that was my interview. I got the call the next day and was like, got the offer. And I just went in as Mr. Uber Geek, and this is what I like doing, and I've got all the toys here in the bag, and I love technology. Rah, rah, rah.
It clearly matters a lot what company you interview for. I had an interview with a company where by the end of it, I spent most of the interview questioning the entire business model of the company, and by the end of it, we were screaming at each other over the whole thing. And then the person said, okay, so you want the job? Because this was awesome. And I was like, seriously?
By the way, that's social engineering right there. What he did.
Yep. That's all that it is.
Yep.
All you have to do is go to LinkedIn nowadays, read what their stupid stuff says. Oh, this is what I'll say to you. For the most part.
Yeah, I'll tell you about the radio station story when we're done. We've got a lot of questions here.
All right, so as you've all been in the industry for so long, X amount of years, what happens when you find a vulnerability inside the company you work for and you tell them? And they don't believe you.
And they don't believe you?
They didn't get a
filler.
They don't care.
Short
the
stock. Actually, wait, is that illegal? That'd be illegal.
No.
Private
as a person.
No.
Yeah, that's
what
they don't
believe.
Quick little part of it is I asked, so we're a security team at a small company that I was working for at the time. We don't have anything facing out. We don't have to worry about being hacked. I said, okay, and walked away from the CTO.
Document it to cover your ass. Keep copies of your documentation. Make sure it's signed off on. Have your resume ready to go just in case.
All right, you done.
Thanks.
All right.
Anybody
else? No?
Okay.
Next question.
All right. We got on the subject of Internet of Things, and it sounded like there's a lot we can talk about there. So my wife and I were remodeling our kitchen, and yes, we saw the fancy techie refrigerators, and I had just started a job working in application security. And talked to my friends about this. I thought it was kind of odd that my fridge could now be connected to the internet, and they explained why this was a bad idea, and I kind of understood it already, but it was just confirmation.
I'm sorry, Dave, I can't open the refrigerator door. You exceeded your calorie intake for the day.
Having a conversation with one of the salespeople was quite entertaining. The new fridges, the cooling mechanisms in the back, the piping and all that, the tubing, it is now enclosed. The reason why it's enclosed is basically this shortens the functional life of the refrigerator. This is a business model. You can pay someone every year to come out and remove this backing and clean off the elements because dust builds up on them, and them being open was actually allowing your system to continue to run. But now that it's enclosed, now that it's sealed, the airflow is restricted. And I said, well, you know, if this thing's connected to the internet, and how long is that software going to be supported by the company? You know, because eventually they're going to stop supporting it, and then what? And they said, well, that's part of the reason why we now have this backing on the refrigerators. We're expecting the serviceable life of a refrigerator, which used to be about 20 years, to now be about 4 or 5. So you're buying a new $2,000 fridge every 4 or 5 years. That's the business model, disposable society. So the question, what is your most ridiculous Internet of Things appliance that you've come across?
Oh, yes. There's an IoT dildo, actually.
He wins.
It has a camera attached to it as well.
What? Yes. Where is the camera attached?
It's not nice.
Why?
Apparently it's a fetish or something.
And they're actually in a lawsuit right now over privacy data.
Unless there be a digital dildo.
These things also graph your orgasms.
No.
It's crazy.
Metrics!
Science!
Thank you,
wow, honey, you killed it tonight.
We can't follow up. We're quitting tonight.
That would be 11.
Or 12.
I just had a comment on the refrigerator thing.
Yes.
I think that this is the point now where we, let's say $2,000 for a new refrigerator that's only going to last 4 years, getting a monthly membership at your local makerspace and just building your own fucking refrigerator that will last the rest of your life. That's what I'm thinking. Okay.
Has anyone heard of a network-attached refrigerator that gives you remote control over the like of the little temperature thing inside the refrigerator? Yeah. I'm only concerned about attacks that people can have of like turning your refrigerator a temperature up at night and then like slow like making your food spoil 3 times faster than it's supposed to.
We're losing control. Just jump in.
Yes.
All right. I don't have a question. I did find out the convention. It's called Hackers Halted. I have the code right here for any women who want to attend for free.
And it is zombie oriented, right? That's the zombie.
I think it's Dragon of that.
Oh, well, maybe they change every year. The year I went, it was all zombies.
I just heard about it this year, so awesome. I'm going. So
maybe we can put it on the website.
And you're going to give us a report next year, right?
Sure.
So,
fantastic.
One more really question, more a comment on what was said earlier about the planned obsolescence, where they're specifically designing things to break, so you have to either get a new one, ostensibly is the best option for a business model, or to repair subscription fees. I think the broader scope of hacking has really encouraged a lot of people to say, yeah, fuck that, and go fix it yourself. Case in point, for the refrigerator, just take a backup. You want to open air, just take it off. Another case point, I can't tell you how many jacuzzis I've tried repairing where there's actually no seal to keep the water out from the actual components controlling the heat. Just a little bit of hot glue and like some plastic, you're great. And to take it a step further, if anyone would like to experiment with this, so I recently found out that you have a card writer, you can actually change the string of numbers at the very beginning to make your chip card swipe normally.
Oh.
Ooh.
Oh.
You just became the most popular person.
Yeah. Remember, you can't make it
work for you. Just change it 1, 2, 3, 4, is that
what? I forget it's like the third or fourth digit. It's 3, you change it to a 1 or a 2, it spikes normally.
Wow. I love you.
Yeah, so just play with that.
No more steps. You're stressing me out.
All right. Thank you for your comments.
Just to follow up on the Internet of Things, when I was looking at the refrigerators, you could remotely change the temperature in the refrigerator if all crystal monitor the temperatures and change them. And my biggest fear was actually of the oven, because you could actually remotely turn on the blenders and oven. Big trouble waiting to happen.
Yeah. You remember the name of this product?
Samsung.
It's from Samsung.
They seem to be catching a lot of things on the fire.
They're good at that.
All right. Oh, Mr. Audio Guy in the back, I fixed your broken microphone stand. I just want to let you know.
So, the cryptographer is on the panel. Blake 2 or Ketchak?
What? Huh? I understood the question. I don't have any answer.
Like, which one is preferred for applications, or... I'm trying to get, like, pipe going.
Yeah,
it's
too specific a question.
Ah,
oh
well. I'm sorry, we don't have the 40 ounce or a really cheap shit we can shake up and throw you overhand, but feel free to try it again. I mean, it's...
Bring up lunch wine or pizza, we'll get a fight.
Security is the whack-a-mole. And the moles are winning, I think, not the whackers. How do you reverse that? My personal feel is... putting a lot of stuff in hardware, not that you can't screw up hardware, but it's usually more correct than a lot of software. Not always. I've seen that Intel's probably caught up with Multics from the 60s about 5 years ago. I used to be a systems administrator on the Multics system.
So one thing that you run into is that people really like being able to plug their devices into a USB port in order to be able to fix them. And that was actually, I was talking to somebody at Apple about this, because, so a lot of Android devices, you could plug them in to a serial port if you had a special cable adapter, but you couldn't necessarily be guaranteed of reflashing them over USB. And when you could, it wasn't like a low-level bootloader, you actually could ruin its ability to be flashed over USB, because you could destroy both the primary bootloader that you could just reflash and destroy the actual normal boot process. On iOS, there was a firmware like USB level that you could drop all the way down that you cannot upgrade. And the reason why is they could plug into a USB port. You aren't going to implement the USB protocol fully in like a state machine in hardware, you're going to implement that in software. But as soon as they provided that ability to just guarantee you can always plug into a USB port and fix it, no matter how horribly broken up the processes get, that means there is essentially a pretty hard-coded USB bootloader in there that we found a bug that then that device is just permanently owned. And so it's this weird trade-off of the more stuff you just demand is in like only accessible like, trivial hardware, the less functionality you get, to the point where somebody might not want it anymore.
Yeah, and it's also just worth pointing out, the distinction between hardware and software, I no longer have any idea where to draw that line. Hardware is basically designed, the days that people laid out chips and figured out that this transistor goes here, those are long gone, right? You know, chips are designed by writing software that lays them out and figures out what goes there. FPGAs blur that distinction between hardware and software. And device controllers, are basically fully functioning general purpose computers with a lot of unused capacity. So, the distinction between, telling yourself, oh, don't worry, the hardware handles that, that can't be hacked, we no longer have any of the assurances that this can happen.
The moment hardware has a program counter, it's vulnerable.
I currently do blue team incident response, and of course, as part of that, we have a red team at work as well that we have to deal with. Just kind of a funny note, like for example, we had one incident where our red team actually registered a domain in our department director's name, and then proceeded to send us an email with a malicious macro-enabled document.
Nice.
We ended up having to deal with that and figure out what's coming from our departmentdirector.com. But my question is, do you guys have red teams at your jobs, and what are some
interesting incidents you've had to deal with from them, if you do?
I've been on red team engagements before for clients. I've never been on the blue team side, though. Our most recent run-in, though, when we plugged in a USB drive into something's computer and pulled down, executed some code to get us some stuff on its computer, but they actually caught it instantly, which surprised us. And they confiscated his laptop and didn't have it for the entire day, and they're running around searching for this mysterious process that appeared on his computer and the code that it executed, what it did to his computer. Because apparently the guy who's in charge of testing didn't necessarily tell the blue team and the security operations center that there was a pen test going on. So the poor guy was without a laptop for an entire day and a half until they came back and said, oh, whoops.
Nice. All right, so this is kind of an, this is kind of an open-ended thing.
Pick it up.
What are your guys' thoughts on the Intel? You won't be able to see that on the audio recording. what are your guys' thoughts on the Intel management engine? That's built on the chips? Do you guys think that's like a conspiracy, or do you think that they're really a pain to have on there, especially since there's a disable bit that's recently?
I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. Yeah, no, I don't like it. I don't like what I've read.
It's difficult always to assign intent. There's some things that on Motorola devices, Justin Case, one of the J Case, one of the people who does a lot of Android hacking, which is swears it's a backdoor, but it's really difficult to tell if it's a backdoor or if it was a really lazy engineer.
Yeah,
it
could be both.
Yeah, I mean, I have done reviews of voting systems technology, the voting machines, and first question is it a backdoor in these systems? And the answer is always, if they spent money inserting a backdoor into these systems, that was a complete waste of money because there's so many security vulnerabilities in them. backdoor would be completely redundant, and that's pretty much true of any complex large-scale system. I'm skeptical of the conspiratorial theories.
Every tribute to malice and stupidity, what can be adequately explained by stupidity?
Yeah.
Yes.
Got any other questions at the moment? We could, if y'all want, since it's 11 o'clock, we could take like a 10-minute break if people want to hit the bathroom or refresh drinks or something like that.
I would re-ask my question. How do we get out of the whack-a-mole mode?
Cut all the internet backbone links to Russia and then send the nukes.
Yeah, the Chinese are going to be dealt with too.
That's a warning to China.
As an industry, we don't learn. Like, there are a lot of things that we've kind of gotten to the point of just understanding you never do this, but it takes a decade before we get to the point where we're really teaching people to not do it. An example is the decade of people doing PHP applications and not using and having SQL injection attacks. We have, that should have been fixed immediately, and essentially it's used to immediately remove all the APIs that allow you to do the raw string API, and then actually have the ones with the question marks. There's so many ways that can be addressed. We continue to write programs in programming languages that were really not the right level of scale for that thing. We end up with buffer overflow attacks, and we end up introducing just way too many vulnerabilities.
It's also like every person you hire at your company is technically a mole, because every one of those is a valid attack vector from someone trying to get into your company. Like, if one person clicks a phishing link and types in your credentials, it's done.
Also, don't buy, please.
Quick clarification, I wasn't really serious about nuking Russia just because, I don't want that kind of death and mayhem on my conscience, and I really, really admire the Russian and Soviet space program. I hate Putin and his government, but their space program, considering how little money they have to work with and how much bullshit they have to put up with, it's amazing what they've been able to accomplish with it. So, no nukes for Russia, sorry about that if I upset anyone.
Just Moscow.
I don't give a shit about that.
Sweet
backpedal. Learning to use Metasploit, I came to find there's just all sorts of vulnerabilities in all sorts of programs, some going back, 10, 20 years. Over the years, though, have you run into, just any favorite vulnerabilities that are just so ridiculous that, it's just, how could this even be a thing?
I think it was brought up earlier. SQL injection attacks were so prevalent and they didn't need to be. And it's still going on. You know, it's like the Bobby Tables thing from XKCD. You know? It's like, it's so crazy out there that you would ever inject a string into another string and then call SQL on it. That doesn't make any sense to me. We've all had, in all languages, a way to avoid that. And why is that ever a thing? But the funny thing is, it means sometimes when I go in and say, here's my password, they go, oh, it can't contain a single quote. What the hell? Why can't it contain a single quote? Because they're scared of it being some part, somewhere in the data chain of an SQL attack.
So I mentioned earlier the group Exploiteers does a lot of Internet of Things hacking. They kind of have a shtick, which is like the first thing they do is they will take a device which attaches to the Wi-Fi network, and they will attach it to a Wi-Fi network with an SSID that tries to do a shell injection attack. Because virtually all of these devices are running on Linux, and they will use the Wi-Fi configuration program, the default one, right. And they will just pass the SSID as an argument that they just paste in there. And not that many people have SSIDs that contain like shell quoting and anything like that, and so that usually succeeds.
This one kind of blew me away. We were on an engagement with a very large government organization, and so they already had an IDS set up where they were doing NetFlow, so analyzing shady activity on the network. And they said, no, we already got a product for that. We, you know, don't worry about it. And I'm like, come on, guys, we had an agreement. Let's just hook in our appliance and just monitor the traffic going on. And so I said, sure, go ahead. So we plug it in, and sure, the thing lights up. The alarms are going off. Oh, my God, horrible things. Requests are going to China, going to Russia, everywhere on this network. And we were trying to figure it out, and they tracked down the IP address where it was coming from. And when we got to, when we figured out to the specific laptop where it was coming from, it was a general. And he's like, I don't even use this laptop. Generals don't use laptops, right? So they're like, I don't even use it. And he, well, what do you do with it? The only thing I do with it is charge my e-cigarette on it with the USB cable. And so, sure enough, we take the e-cigarette, and on the back, made in China, and we analyze it. Sure enough, there's malware inside the e-cigarette. And so those are being distributed in the United States. So anyways, I was like, that is awesome.
Another incredibly common thing that is just is how many people not learned yet is JCase's shtick. So when he'll buy the random Chinese Android device, and typically what will happen is that the developers who are working on it, at some point the device stopped booting because the permissions on some folder or some file became wrong. And the developer just cannot figure out where in the system that's happening. Because it was over the course, it only affects the device during boot up or during startup of some process. And you know, it was only when it runs for a few days and they reboot it, it has this issue. So they just freak out and they add to the init scripts chmod 777 that file. And as soon as you have that line in there, you can just replace that file with a symlink to anything you want on the system. And then oftentimes it becomes, the only reason that file permissions would change is because it's in a folder that the user sort of had some weird access to at some point. And so you just target that in any random device driver, any random operating system file, and now you've got control of the system.
So I'm going to answer a slightly different question, like, what's your favorite security bug? And this is a little esoteric, but it's just such a great bug, I wish it were my fault. Before we had SSH, there was a program called Secure Telnet. It's basically Telnet, and it would do a Diffie-Hellman key exchange for the Telnet server, use a DES key to encrypt the traffic data encryption standard key. DES keys were 56 bits long, and that is actually going to be of some relevance. So a Diffie-Hellman key exchange is basically you do some stuff and you get two sides know a random number that anyone monitoring won't be able to figure out, and you use that as a secret, and you use that as your key material for your session. And then you use that to create a DES key, and so on. The Secure Telnet program worked, and some people were using it. Eventually got replaced by SSH. But somebody noticed that somewhere in a version about 5 years before they noticed it, it was always using a key of all zeros. The question is, why is it doing that? And in fact, if you revert back to early versions, it worked just fine. And the thing about it having it be a key of all zeros, it'll still work just fine. You'll successfully communicate, and it'll in fact be encrypted. It's just always going to be encrypted with the same key. Why was this doing it? Well, it turns out there was a bug fix in the DES library. DES keys are 56 bits long, but in fact, the DES key package is 64 bits long. The other 8 bits are parity bits. So, odd or even for each byte of the 7 bytes of the DES key. If you just take a random Diffie-Hellman output, one out of every 256 times, the parity bits will happen to be right. The other 255 times, they're going to be wrong, and it'll be invalid. The old DS library had a bug in it that it didn't check for parity bits, and it would just let me load any key even if the parity bits were invalid. The new version of the DS library fixed this bug and would reject key loads if they had an incorrect parity bit. But the code didn't actually check to see if it had been rejected. And so, 255 out of 256 times you would use Secure Telnet, it would never set the key, and it would just stay at all zeros. Even though when the code was originally written, it worked fine, and it was a bug fix that caused it to be an undetected security flaw, passively exploitable for 5 years.
Amazingly, the all zeros has another implication in our history and security. That was the code that launched the Minuteman.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want anybody to forget it, so it's all zeros.
Can you do secure injection on prepared statements?
Depends on how those are constructed. If they're constructed by concatenating strings, bad. If they're constructed by having placeholders, no problem.
Yeah, I'm thinking prepared statements are okay.
Yeah, it depends, of course, as I think what Randall's kind of getting at, but I just want to make it more clear, is that the underlying SQL driver that you're using, particularly if you're using like JDBC, had a lot of pluggable backend drivers, and so you'd oftentimes have somebody who didn't really know what they were doing writing the actual underlying driver, and they might do string concatenation or implement the pluses, sorry, or implement like the question marks, which is really important. And then there was a class of like no SQL injection attacks where it looked like you had something where you had a good placeholder and it was entirely structured in JSON objects. But it turns out that certain JSON keys that began with a dollar sign were actually a query language, and so people could actually pass in. Yeah, it was just, you have to be a little bit careful with that sort of thing, but if the people who are writing the underlying libraries are sane, then no.
Cool. Good question.
Pull it down.
I'll just do this right here.
James Brown.
Okay, so I go to Jacksonville State University in Alabama, and they are one of the few colleges who still teach COBOL, because COBOL is considered to be a bad language. My teacher told me about this patch that they did for Y2K, where everything after the year 38 is just fine, and it's considered, you have to put them. Everything after the year 38 has a 19 in front of it. Everything before has the 20. So we're going to have another Y2K, but why 2038?
We're going to have a much bigger 2038 problem because of Unix.
Yeah. Oh, yes. God. What's your general opinion on that?
Just for people who don't know, it's a 32-bit number of seconds since the epoch of 1970 is 2038.
I just wanted to know everyone's opinion on that.
Scary.
My direct opinion on that fix is that I understand why they did it. Because they were like, you know what, all the rest of our computers are going to stop working in 2038, so we're going to have to address this problem then anyway. So we may as well make this stop working at the same time.
I'll probably be dead by then anyway.
You're stockpile guns and food, yeah. If you get an old car that doesn't have any computer chips or anything, you get more gas, and we're all going to race endlessly over a devastated landscape, style, and it's going to be fucking sweet.
Wait, is this when we switch to Windows? Is Windows a
It's fun to think that, and I of course said a lot of the same things in 1998, but then the year 2000 happened, and despite the the video feed of the ball dropping in New York, switching to Washington, D.C., where it was all black for some reason, 2 seconds before the thing, and I'm like, it's happening! Nothing happens.
You got to get your job right.
I was sitting in a data center with a backup generator ready to switch over, and yeah, we actually had a rifle with some ammo there just because one of the managers thought shit might go down. It's like, yeah, okay, you know, I'll sit here, you can pay me triple time, and then I'm going to go join my partying friends at 9:30, so
for me. I was on a plane over the Atlantic Ocean.
And I got LASIK surgery in mid-99 because I said, if this is going to go down bad, at least I want to be able to watch it.
I only ask because I've read, I obviously didn't really get to experience it, I was neat, but I've read a lot of articles for people who were working crazy hard during the actual incident itself. And I'm all, you have words?
I gotta ask, has anyone else in IT gotten this? Because I've heard this on two separate occasions post Y2K, where clueless management people, after the dot-com bubble burst, were laughing, going, see, this is our revenge on you IT nerds for lying to us about that Y2K bullshit so you can make all that money, because nothing happened. I mean, you think you were pulling a fast one over us, and you got greedy, and ha-ha, the tech bubble collapsed, and now we're in charge again, and we're going to fuck you over. Honestly believe Y2K was an IT conspiracy.
Well, I have to counterpoint that with, well, of course, you're probably supporting my point about now, which is, if you read the Risks Digest throughout the previous couple years before Y2K, you saw there was a lot of stuff going on to fix it. That's the reason nothing happened. We fixed it.
You're welcome.
And here's the point. Some of the stuff that was fixed for Y2K actually broke in 2001.
Not me. They had a patch
that worked for just 1 year. In 2001, though, things broke. It was pretty crazy.
I'm hoping to get some insight. I mentioned before that I'm a mechanic. And if you actually look at the network map they make for modern cars, they're putting absolutely everything on a parallel network. So if anyone goes down, including the door switch, the door lock actuator, the trunk light, the lights themselves are on the network now. Your PCM, the one that runs the engine, will go down. Why would you put everything on one network as opposed to putting two networks?
It is. Here's the big thing, though. These are the attack vectors that are now taking over smart cars with, where they're actually able to break in through your entertainment system and then say, put on the brakes. That is crazy. That should not be on the same network. Even there's some airplanes designed that way too, so we're actually seeing some issues there. But they're trying to get those more into separate networks and stuff, but no, wait. Idiots.
The DEF CON car hacking videos are terrifying. Truly terrifying.
And awesome.
Does that
and awesome. And awesome. I agree, but
if you go back and listen to the hacking panel we had on hacking and self-driving cars, it's like, well, yesterday, 2 days ago, something like that, right?
I was doing space crash. Sorry.
Okay.
Right. Well, you probably covered it in that. Then I just want to note that there's absolutely no security to any of the settings inside the thing. I can access it with no credentials whatsoever with just my laptop.
We have a lot of clueless people creating secure, or creating what should be secure software, yes.
So I used to do, there was a company that I worked for a while, because I consulted for a while, it was Vitronics. They build a lot of car diagnostics tools. And one thing I will say is certainly not all cars have the problem, it's all on the same bus. There often are separate buses for the more critical things. Nothing else is just gets swamped by the simpler things. But there's also this question that comes up. So as mentioned, like the lack of security for the settings you can do with a laptop. I'm highly concerned if Johnny X over here can do it from like his house and he can attack my car, as was the case when Charlie Miller was doing that with I think it was the Toyota vehicles. Well, Charlie Miller, when he was doing it remotely, I'm not as concerned, but I should be somewhat concerned if somebody can do it inside my car. And so the thing is, that's weird about that, right, is that I hear people talk a lot about the security that needs to happen inside. Like, if you manage to get the ODB2 port inside my car and have all sorts of security cameras on there, you can just cut damn brake lines. There's so many things you can do to my car if you were actually, like, at my car, in my car. You can put water in my gas tank. You can you can just break part of my transmission. Like, there's so many things that you can do that I'm not actually that concerned about your ability to plug a port into my car and modify some of the software settings if you're already at my car, particularly if you're already sitting inside of my car with access to the diagnostics port. But yeah, network accessible cars would really freak me out.
Yeah, although car-to-car communication is, you know, kind of the next generation.
Yeah, that is freaking me out. But there was the car panel, which was, yeah, I went to part of that, and they were talking about the car-to-car communication, and I'm just sitting there, and it's just like, no. Because there's no way you can verify that the GPS coordinates that are being sent are accurate. You can't. There's no cryptographic primitive you're going to be able to utilize or verify that location is correct. There's no way you're going to be able to verify any of the information sent in any of the cars. And so you could just buy some cars and then just make pretend whatever you're trying to do with them.
Yeah, I mean, if the vehicle ahead of you says he stopped all of a sudden down to 20 miles an hour, is that going to immediately stop you?
Yeah, it's like if we're going to do this, we really need to be just thinking about the local primitives of the individual cars are having, and then if there's any kind of network information, you can use that. I can say using it as a hint, I'm concerned with just I've seen people use hints in order to try to affect the probability of behavior in certain ways. But I find network accessible anything really scary, and network accessible cars.
Be afraid. Ask your next question, but be afraid.
So I wanted to say one thing. The point you just made about actual access to the ODB2 port / brake line / transmission / whatever else, physical security is always key. I wanted to change gears with you guys. What do you think of voice biometrics?
I work for another couple days.
I have seen.
The convolutional neural networks now are so good that actually there was a demo 2 months ago of taking Donald Trump and Barack Obama and constructing very, very convincing speech from them, and particularly use that as an adversarial model against the systems that are trying to read your biometrics. And when you do these adversarial models, it can actually be really weird because it might generate static, and the other system might go, "Oh, that's Barack Obama," because it's just the exact thing that it's.
There was a thing on BBC about that a couple months ago, where they tested two different companies' engines, and one of them, they took twins. One of the presenters happened to be twins at the show, and they took twins, like identical twins. They put them through voice acting classes to teach them how to sound like each other, and then tested. And one engine caught it, and one engine not. And I thought that was super interesting, and I wanted to know if you guys had any insights.
You know, the fundamental problem of biometric authentication for anything is, you know, you can't change your password, right? That, you know, if your body is the thing generating it, and it gets compromised, and someone finds a way to emulate that, you know, you're stuck with it. You know, if it's a fingerprint, okay, maybe you have 9 backup fingers at some point. That you can use, but you know, you only have one voice, right? You only have 2 eyes, so this is a pretty short-sighted model, particularly because it guarantees sort of authenticator reuse among other things. So it's just misguided.
And I would add to implementation. If you were in my earlier talk hacking mobile applications, this was an example where. This app mobile application had voice recognition. That was your login. Hi, my name is Ray. You would record that and it would let you log in. Okay, that's cool, and it worked. It was great. Anyone else would talk into it, try to sound like it, it wouldn't let you in. Well, when we started testing the app, we started looking at the data directory of that application, mobile app, and the tester had found there was a random file there, and it was something like zebra.xyz. It made no sense. And when he had opened that file up, and we're looking at it, and it looked like it was garbage. So it was binary, encrypted, it was something. And when we took a closer look up near the top, we started seeing things like genre, year made, album title. And so...
it's a RIF format file with your voice.
It was straight up MP3. So what we did is we drug the file off onto the guy's computer, renamed it MP3, hit play, held the phone up. Hi, my name is Ray, and unlocked it. So implementation of biometrics, too, is pretty... that's not the right way to go about it.
And it's like, if you're doing facial recognition with one camera, and you have a picture of the person, you just show a picture of the person, and it's going to let you in.
And then also with these, with voice, to bring up what Matt was saying, something else is that at least your fingerprints, you might have to be close to the person in order to try to get it. In the case of a in the case of like an iris scan, like how often do you have a high resolution photo of somebody's eye? You can just call somebody up on the phone and just pretend to be, you know, somebody random talking to them for a couple minutes, and now you have their voice. Like it voice is just such an easy one to pull from just about anybody.
The applications I like the most about kind of spin-off applications are being able to build libraries if you've got enough source material. I've got a lot of recordings of William S. Burroughs and Hunter S. Thompson, and I've been feeding that in some of the spin-off applications so I can have guys who've been dead for years and decades do new station IDs for my radio show. Now, I'm William S. Burroughs, and I'm dead. You're listening to that type of stuff.
I just want to say one thing. I actually do work for a company that deals with voice biometrics, not in the research department, but on the national implementation side. It's not entirely true that you only have one voice. It very much does depend on how old you are and how you're feeling, because if you call in and like your institution or whatever that employs our product does all this stuff while you're sick, it's not going to sound like if you call in when you get healthy, it's not going to recognize you. And additionally, if you call in and all this setup happens when you're 25, it might not necessarily register when you're 45. So it's not entirely correct to say there is, like, you have just one voice in this situation, like you only have 10 sets of fingerprints.
I think the point is, it's like the worst part of both sides, right? It's not going to be reliable, and you can't do anything to consciously change it.
Now, to back up Matt's point on that, I'm going to say that the way you would take advantage of that, like the way that as a user, if you know you have great recordings of my voice and you can simulate it, the way that I would have to take advantage of that is either waiting for my voice to change as my voice box grows or a little bit or weakens over the course of another 5 to 10 years, or I would have to purposely get sick every time I want to log into my computer. it's just an inability to do quick key revocation is essentially what the point was about.
So back in my tech support days, I had some very interesting phone calls with some very angry customers. For example, one of which, my job involved dealing with firewalls at fast food restaurants and parking garages. We got a call one day where I was dealing with a customer, and they needed to make a firewall change, but we, of course, had to get approval from the franchise. And the guy basically told me, "You don't make this firewall change right now, I'm gonna come there and slit your throat." And just crazy stuff like that. But have you guys ever had just like any just crazy experiences back in tech support? I imagine we've all worked at that, you know, in that type of job at some point or another.
My throat's never been slit.
It's not gonna be money. When you deliver reports of vulnerabilities to clients, and stuff like that, a lot of times they'll be very antagonistic about it, even though you're trying to help them. So I've definitely had people that say, like, "No, that's not a real finding. Like, that's not correct." It's like I have the steps to reproduce there. There's screenshots. There's everything that you need to see that it's actually wrong. They say, "No, that's not true. I don't agree." There's nothing to agree on, but it happens all the time. So
we include screenshots with every report that we do on an assessment because we get that all the time. "No, that's not a vuln. That's not a vuln. Look, right here, your username and password was logged out. You know, you're using logged in or whatever. You know, to the console. It's a vulnerability, and we do that for that because we do the pushback."
The not exactly a tech support nightmare, just a kind of funny tech fail when I was working for the porn site web hosting place. We had, we monitored the servers to check if the load shot up to ridiculous levels for some reason. Everything was pretty homogenized, and you could get in and run scripts across the entire data center. We had some audio alerts, blah, blah, blah. And I was working day shift with one other sysadmin one day, and this one particular server, when you started getting these audio alerts every couple of minutes that, basically, we filled around and realized that var was filled up, /var. And we looked in, and there were all these files in there they were AVIs for anime shows. And we're like, what the hell? Call a customer up real quick. Hey, were you short on storage or something? You got all these anime videos sitting here in slash R. It's causing problems with your server and probably interfering with a lot of customers' orgasms. Can we delete this stuff? And you're like, damn, I don't know what the fuck that is. Yeah, go ahead and nuke it all. And so, delete. We delete it, and everything's fine. Server's running fine. And a couple minutes later, we get the warning again, and we check, and there's some anime stuff in there, and bar is filling up. There's also a text file that said, "Whoever deleted the animes is gonna be in trouble." .text. And all the customer back up and said, "Have you installed any scripts or anything recently on your machine?" Said, "Well, yeah, we've got this PHP script we installed a couple hours ago." And it's like, "Okay, you should probably disable that for now, because apparently there's a vulnerability that's being exploited. And they're like, oh my god. So went back in, we cleaned out slash R again, we made sure the script was disabled. Before we made sure the script was disabled, we left a text file in there that said, "Shouldn't have filled up var, or we never would have noticed." Fuckhead. And then we deleted and we nuked the script, and yeah.
What I'm bringing up here is not necessarily a question for you guys, but something for everybody in the panel to play around with. I have gone to Best Buy. I've gone to Fry's, I've gone to Micro Center. Very often they will have a remote control sitting by their TVs on display. Most of the TVs nowadays are smart TVs. So you can connect your phone to that and walk away. And if you wanted to, you could play porno TVs or whatever, just to keep up with people.
Are you the guy who's been putting Goatsy on all the TVs?
I have done that.
This is why Home Depot had to turn off the Wi-Fi on their fridges, because that exact thing happened.
This is why we can't have nice things.
But teach these stores not to leave the remotes out, exploit the fuck out of it, and teach them a lesson.
Alleged.
Smart TVs. We should do a smart TV panel and scare the hell out of people who don't know much about it and show how easily they can be turned into spy devices.
Smart TV panels.
So, going back to the biometrics. Would you guys think about keyboard dynamics as one? Because to me, that just doesn't seem like a viable option to like authenticating yourself.
I hear that it works. I hear that it's some of the things you can figure out from. I mean, there's keyboard dynamics for biometrics, and then there's a very very related thing, which is like you can just like hear the or feel the vibrations of somebody using the keyboard, like on a mobile phone or something. You can just feel like they're typing, all that. But it just comes back to Matt's point about how the way in which I type is something that I've kind of built up over the course of many years, and if somebody else this records me typing, possibly by just being inside of an application on my phone, if it's that kind of typing, or sitting on my computer and it's just reading from my keyboard temporarily, then they can build up those same patterns and essentially build up that same model and then generate me. So.
Cool, thank you.
I'm just curious whether or not you guys have ever encountered something that occurred to me a long time ago, and that was people are always worried about viruses getting into the RAM and everything like that. Well, we've also got the RAM that's in the video cards. Has anybody ever actually done anything to try and infect those instead and put some kind of virus in there that would take a virtual machine? I mean, obviously you'd have to tailor it to every video card that was on the market, which would be tricky, but it seems like you should be able to do something along those lines. You've got code that in there that gets run.
Yeah, so I think RAM is going to check up on whether these things exist. But when you say like RAM, though,
I'm saying... Well, what I'm saying, memory that's in a video game, you can reprogram it, put in new
Are video cards typically firmware upgradable?
BIOS.
I recall reading some like proof of concept paperwork, papers on, but that doesn't mean that there's anything that's actually been implemented in the BIOS.
I mean,
there's a lot of scary proof of concept stuff that people put out there and decide
stuff gets closed.
It just seems doable. Practical. Yeah, you're talking about the e-cigarette kind of hack. That's the same
thing. Hang on, let us Google that for you. We'll have an answer for you in a few minutes.
Just Google GP.
Next question, Walter.
We're working on this.
I'm just curious if y'all have any stories of tech bloopers or blunders that just kind of were incredibly random. This was actually during that interview I mentioned earlier. There was about 15 support engineers, and they were like, okay, assess the Bluetooth. So I have my iPad. I like to name my personal hotspot random things for shits and giggles. And in a room of about 15 people, it says, now connected to Daddy Loves Cocaine and Big Black Cock. And I just stood there frozen, and I was wondering if y'all had any funny stories like that.
I got boatloads of them. I am not kidding you, because in like 2001, 2002, when we were writing WebInspect, it was kind of the new thing, right? So automated penetration testing. You point an app at a website, and it just has that SQL injection, cross-site scripting. But at the same time, we're just injecting tons of shit at people's backends. So.
Sounds like a day at the porno place.
We had an example where we had a large airline as a customer. They were trying us out. And so we got their information for their website. They were supposed to give us their staging website, but they gave us their production website. We booked an entire flight with people named Jack Frost and Fred Flintstone. And they didn't realize for months that it had happened. And we actually had the entire plane booked because we had to go to a form. Right, you're submitting this data to buy a ticket.
Right.
And sure enough, it just took up the whole flight, and we've done crazy stuff like that. But it was kind of their fault, which was good, that they gave us the wrong server to point at.
So, yeah, when we did the voting system review for a certain Midwestern state about 10 years ago, they sent us a bunch of voting machines to act with. And assured us that these machines would never be used in a real election. And so we felt free to be as destructive and creative and malicious as we could with them. One of the machines they sent was the optical scanners used for in precinct counted optical scanners, where you fill out the bubble sheet and submit it at your voting polling place. The DRE machines, the touchscreen machines, and also. The big machine that counts the absentee ballots. And so we loaded, is the camera right? Yeah. So we loaded some stuff. Well, on the machine that runs the absentee ballot counting is a big bulk scanner. It weighs like 1,000 pounds. It had to be delivered by truck, and it's hard to get in the room. It was a little surprising to us that they said they were never going to use this again after they loaned it to us. But we said, "Are you sure?" And it'll never be used again. So we modified the machine so that you had to solve a puzzle in order to count the ballots. Come November, during the actual election, with this call saying. We think you know something about these machines because you wrote the report on them. Can you maybe you can help us out? It's in this mode. It's not in the manual. There's this puzzle that we have to solve with the thing up. And,
Oh wow!
Are you in that state that we did this for? Well, one of the counties. You can't use that machine. the other problem is that the end result was. Would always have me in the election for overlord. they actually used that to count ballots. I've been governor for overlord in the state.
So one of the questions earlier was about having a GPU virus. And with a quick Google, I got headline, got a Bitcoin mining virus on my PC. GPU is under full load when idle. Now that doesn't mean it's a GPU virus per se, it might be just a Windows virus that's driving the GPU. But yes, so that is already been seen in the
world. We're still over in...
Well,
I'm talking about actually going into the GPU itself. Any virus system is going to detect that.
I don't know.
It's into there. I mean, I can judge that.
Well, apparently this guy in this thread took a lot of work to try to get it finally off his system. It wasn't just straight virus detection or gun, because probably it didn't have the kind of payload that would normally be for a Windows virus.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's probably part of it. I don't know that your GPU has any state between reboots, so I don't know that you can actually put anything there.
I think that's
I can push the firmware to it. You know,
okay.
Somebody has to put a payload into the firmware.
That's why I don't know about the
firmware.
Cool.
I think they could do that. I don't know that they
said.
Anyway, at least Bitcoin has happened.
So you guys might appreciate this, because I'd just like to add one thing to the Uber Reel. A close colleague of mine actually works for the school system, and that's just going to go downhill from there. They decided to deploy Chromebooks for the entire county for a couple of different high schools, and someone in the IT department forgot to flash actual OS that was secured onto any of them. So there was about 2,000 Chromebooks that were just open that you could do anything with. And they had to recall all of those over the course of like 3 months, and they didn't get 500 of them back. But I did actually have a constructive question for you. Has there actually been a point where you guys, I was going to ask for a success story that you heard was particularly memorable, that was something that was kind of difficult to catch, but you were able to turn things around for whoever it is you're working for?
You stumped us, you didn't even.
Are you sure you want to go into this career?
We can remember our failures like that, but we're drawing a line on our successes. Maybe we're just in the wrong.
Clearly, it's just that we succeed so often that it's no longer memorable for us.
I'll just ask this question next year. Maybe you'll remember something.
It's hard because there's no winning, right? I mean, yeah, we find vulnerabilities all the time. We tell the customers, look, you got straight up SQL injection right here. Great. You know, we feel good, but the next test comes through the next month, and there's something even more egregious, right? So it's kind of weird. It's just a rolling thing. So that's kind of hard to measure, I think.
Well, thanks for the DragonCon team and stumping the panel.
Yes.
Yeah. I wish we had beer to throw at you.
I don't know how much of the article I read was just pie in the sky, fluff, whatever, but there was a tech article I briefly skimmed a few months ago about hacking air-gapped systems that have no forms of external communications. They were talking about things like using fan speed to send signals to an audio microphone left near it, thermal transmission heating up the GPU in order to send a binary patch that like was it 8 bits a minute or something like that. But I don't know how realistic any of that could be, if you'd have to have at least a receiver really close to it that would also be able to get the data out.
As I mentioned, there's a lot of really scary as shit proof of concept papers out there, but fortunately, a lot of them don't actually make it out into the wild. But yeah, I read some stuff about making hard drive lights blink, making lights on display lights on routers blink. If you've owned an Internet of Things camera system, you can do stuff like that, just gradual infiltration. But again, I know of no actual incidents that have happened, at least some have been publicly reported. So,
wait for the singularity.
It's definitely a thing. For like a few hundred bucks on a weekend, you could actually do it yourself with keyboards. Even if you have a hardwired keyboard to your desktop or whatever, and you're air-gapped from that, you can use an SDR, and you can actually read like passive radio signals that your keyboard is giving off when you hit buttons, and you can map those to specific keys on the keyboard.
HPS.
And so you can actually just keylog someone over an air-gap network, and there's lots of proof of concepts out there of people actually succeeding in doing that. I think someone named A Bad Idea did a DEF CON talk about it, about how she was able to do that just over a week in the office.
So are you saying when I go home, I'm going to have to buy a whole bunch of chicken wire and screen and build a Faraday cage around my house?
Yeah.
It's actually
has like a similar
Tempest.
Yeah, the Tempest program is specifically designed
Tempest
to prevent that
back. It's a thing again?
Yeah.
Government program never go away. I had a student, a PhD student like Gaurav Shah, read his thesis. It's on covert channels in different places. And, you know, he said keyboard covert channels that can be read over the internet, across, 20 hops of routers, timing channels, and in different devices. And the thing is, these things don't get exploited in the wild very often, and we don't take them seriously, right up until they are exploited in the wild, and then suddenly they become kind of crisis-level things. So, yeah, and, you know, in some sense, you take a little comfort in the fact that, some of these proof of concepts haven't been exploited yet. Then I come back to reality and realize that because they haven't been exploited, no one's fixing them, instead of waiting for someone to exploit them.
Or maybe somebody has, you guys haven't thought of
it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's also worth just bringing up that a lot of times we prove concepts of like really high-powered exploits that maybe one day would need to be used if it weren't for the fact that right now you just put on a high-vis vest, walk in, say that you're here to repair the air ducts in that room, go to that room, plug a USB key into the air gap computer. I mean, it's just, there's just so many fails in the entire security process of all these things that...
So this question, I guess, is a culmination of everything you've been saying right now. I mean, this is dumb. who picked up the whole thing? No one's going to do that. So you, like, know how to break things. You understand how things work. You were here, like, as this stuff was starting. I would assume there's some degree of paranoia that comes into your field. What? And there's all these different ways to interface with computers, biometrics. Like, I read this thing, like a DNA hack, someone encoded, like, let's just code on some DNA and put it into a system and get some horrible stuff. What point do you get so paranoid that you just stop getting certain things? Like, is there like a phone point that's like too advanced and you don't like mesh that anymore? Like, at what point do you stop interfacing with technology and become like primitive to be able to protect yourself?
Well, maybe as soon as I go home. I mean, this is really fucking depressing. Be a painter or something, you know?
You learn all this scary stuff, and you realize, like, I keep returning to the fact that I have no idea how to secure my phone, right? I'm good at this stuff. But, you know, if somebody, a determined adversary is going to be able to find a way to own catastrophic. And, you know, my choice is to go and, you know, go to a remote island and go completely off the grid and, live my life, in a way that I'm probably not well equipped to do without dying really quickly. Right? So, you know, I am unfortunately poorly adapted to, you know, a world without modern society. And unfortunately, this is all we can do is, you know, keep crying out, run the bear.
I'd say there certainly are some things that you can do that are like pushing your risks more than other things, and you can kind of like minimize those risk factors. I mean, like, I'm not particularly interested in having one of those assistants that I can speak to constantly listening in my apartment. That one I avoid. I don't upload all of my photos automatically to iCloud or Google Photos. I don't want to have all the stuff that I have like that. But I do, because I've gotten into politics recently. It's actually really difficult to communicate effectively with people if you don't have Facebook, you're not running Facebook pages, or just everyone else is using Facebook. You have to rerun events and be able to put things on there, and so I do use Facebook a lot, even though I go and I give talks at hackathons about the horrors and evils of centralized systems such as Facebook. There's some things that it's like be really difficult for me to not have a phone. It is currently, at least, very easy for me to not have a network attached refrigerator. So I avoid a network attached refrigerator.
And that won't be true.
That might not be true at some point. That'll be really great.
I don't click on links on emails. That's my rule. I don't care if it's from family. I don't care who it's from. I'm not clicking on anything.
So then, at what point did the threats worth it?
It's kind of just about realizing the context in which your actions are being performed. Like, if you're trying to hack a bank or something, don't do it from your home Wi-Fi. But I'm sending photos to like a family member. Do it on Facebook. What do you have to lose?
All right, quick announcement before we get to the next question. Pizza's about 10 minutes away, so as soon as we get the, it's here, we'll abandon the Marriott and rush in a mad frenzy across the sky bridge to grab the pizza before anyone else can get it. Also, I forgot I was supposed to mention this earlier. How many of you are either in school studying something aerospace related or have aerospace experience and would be interested in attending a, it's not an official NASA convention, but it's run by a bunch of NASA rocket scientists and they're looking to expand their base of presenters at the next convention. And the topic is laying the engineering, putting the engineering in place for launching our first interstellar probe within the next 10 years, and we've got funding. So I have cards and information about this year's convention, and come see me when we leave the room, and I'll be more than happy to talk to you about that and let you know who you need to speak to at NASA if you're interested in getting involved in presenting at the next convention and seeing what we've already got in place. Okay, sorry about that. Next question.
Not really a question. Three things. One, security process is not a goal. Until you get people to understand that, they're going to be dead in the water. It doesn't matter. They're just going to give themselves up over time. Two, China's having more fun right now GPSing you with your little robot vacuum. And it's calling home and telling them to get a complete layout of your home.
Yeah.
Fun times. Three, don't stop learning.
No,
every day.
Never stop learning. Never.
Because it's getting really, really easy to do this to people.
Some of the problems I'm running into, I work for a major security software firm on site as a resident consultant.
Can you get closer to the mic?
Sure. I work for a resident consultant for a major software firm, security software firm. And they did a pen test for the environment, which they didn't tell me about. So all of a sudden, I have everything going on. And then about like a week later, I'm like, what's going on, guys? I'm getting hit by these two networks, these two IP addresses. And I'm like, oh, yeah, go ahead and put that in the IPS as safe as secure, because we're not getting the results we want coming out of the pen test. So the next thing I know is every time I turn around, they're like, well, yeah, this is quite safe. Go ahead and put it in. And then I get that pen test they wanted to provide, but they wanted to provide the software. How do you fight that kind of stuff? Especially since they're going against the software I'm trying to purchase to buy.
Yeah, I guess part of it is kind of a valuable exercise in my experience to turn those things off while doing the pen test, because you want to see if someone does discover like an IDS bypass of some kind, which happens all the time, how far are they going to get? Like, how much are you relying on the systems?
So it'd be normal for them to come in and say, hey, look, you caught it on the first layer, go ahead and turn off this. You caught it on the second layer, go ahead and turn it off so we can keep
It's definitely valuable to find out where exactly in your system are you going to stop finding things.
In the interest of the Internet of Things, and I'm sorry, I keep going back to, has there been any major advantages in hacking said devices in order to turn off the functionality without disabling them? Like, in a vehicle, you can't turn off OnStall without the CPU going absolutely crazy. But I would love to find a way that I could break the antenna to make it think it's still there, still talking, when it's not.
Don't buy that fridge, man.
I don't have that fridge. I gave the salesman a good earful about why I'm not getting that stove either.
Yeah, I'm seeing more and more questions on various tech forums about where to find non-smart, insert whatever device you're looking for. So, comments?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the problems is architectural. A lot of these systems are designed essentially where it's smart and it's on the internet, but there's another part of that which is even more disturbing, which is it's dependent on a server that's run by the manufacturer. And that's a kind of very typical architecture for IoT devices that need remote access in order to, you configure it through a server, not running on the device, but running at the vendor.
Now, one problem is, you know, the vendor goes out of business, and now your device suddenly can't be reconfigured and might stop working. The other problem is that if you don't connect it, it won't work at all, right? And so it must have an internet connection in order to work, period. And that architecture is particularly hostile to the disabling the smart functionality.
Example from earlier in the evening, the Samsung smart TVs, roughly $2,000, that ship without working firmware, just a bootloader that has to be connected. You have to connect it to the internet to download the firmware to make your TV work because they didn't have the firmware finished when they shipped the hardware. And oops, they made a mistake and just bricked your $2,000 TV. Fresh out of the box.
In response to an earlier question about how much tech do you adopt considering the security vulnerabilities, being new to the security field and talking with lots of people more experienced than me, explaining it in layman's terms, it's good for everyone to remember that security is about risk management, how much risk you're willing to accept, because you will accept some. There's always going to be some level of risk you're going to have to accept as long as you're working in tech. The other big piece of advice I got was for anybody working in security, it's we are auditors, we are not the police. Unless we are. there are some, but our role in security is to make sure everyone is aware of what risk there is so that those in charge can make decisions about whether or not they're willing to accept that risk rather than saying, you have this risk, and because you have this risk, you're not allowed to do X, Y, or Z. So any feedback or input on those two pearls of wisdom that I've received?
Yes.
I can add. So we get a lot of pen tests from very large enterprise customers, and it's really good to see that many of them have rules set up where if they get any, say, medium highs or critical vulnerabilities, they are not allowed to ship the app, and that's their rule, not our rule. So we report back, hey, here's what we found, and they put processes in place to go sync up with us on those vulnerabilities, and they do stop applications from shipping. Now, those are the good guys. There's other people that don't care, but it's good whenever I see that. It warms my heart when they say, yeah, there's a high vulnerability here, and that they do actually hold up releases. It puts pressure on us because they yell at us and they challenge us. They say, no, that's not a vulnerability, but you know, we back it up. And it's good to see that. So companies are coming around to that, and they're taking security more seriously, I believe. And hopefully that just keeps continuing.
On a personal level, as far as risk mitigation goes, for myself, family, friends who aren't as tech savvy, especially those who live in areas where there's a lot of activity, a lot of wireless stuff going on, I know there are people out there who will always come up with, smarter than me, will always come up with stuff I can't defend against, but I can make sure that my family, friends, and myself, we're not the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Another good rule of thumb, that don't be the low-hanging fruit. Yeah. Make sure there's an easier target around there for someone malicious to go after.
You don't have to outswim the shark, you just have to outswim everybody else.
Bingo. Thank you.
So my question is more of a sort of a theory and philosophical question. So DARPA was recently awarded some insane amount of money for brain machine interfaces, like full dive tech. So what are your thoughts on when we become Internet of Things devices?
Back in the 80s, if you had asked me, I would have been all for the Neuromancer type implants, jack me in. Woohoo! Nowadays, yeah, sure, if they develop the technology, they guinea pig on it, they guinea pig test it on a whole lot of other people first, and as long as it's not implanted or embedded in me and I can turn it off, then yeah, I'll give it a try. I'm not going to be a pioneer, though.
Okay, I was also curious on your thoughts on biohacking. In general, like gene splicing, like homebrew gene splicing and all that jazz.
terrifying, but hell yeah. Dude, I want to live forever, and I want to be healthy, too.
So one of the reasons why I do the things that I do the way that I do, as opposed to, for example, working behind the scenes or doing responsible disclosure or anything like that, is an attempt to make people aware of the security vulnerabilities that they live with constantly, and to make developers aware of the techniques that they're using to try to build the things that they're doing are actually harming people. And I travel to many developer-oriented conferences, iPhone development conferences, or to try to give explanations of the kinds of mistakes that they're making, these fundamental thought process errors that they're making in the applications that they develop, in the hope of trying to get them to not do that. I don't know if that's making any dent at all, but maybe if we all do that, maybe we can educate people, and we can get users to care, we can get developers to care, and we can try to change what ends up happening. Because it just feels like a dystopia to me that we're going to have to need the network accessible refrigerator, that we're going to have the network accessible brain implant, and that we're going to then end up becoming completely, you know, just.
Don't forget the building.
Thanks for being
so, just to bring it up to a kind of down-to-earth example, you remember last year security flaws were found in a bunch of implantable medical devices, the pacemakers, and so on. Okay, so, you know, the question, now you've got the question, what if you need a pacemaker? You know, you should not get a pacemaker if you need one. Because it has security flaws in it, you know. So yeah, that's a tough decision. But sometimes, you know, the benefits outweigh the risks.
And apparently, right now they're recalling people with pacemakers to come in or to get firmware upgrades to their pacemaker, but which is not necessarily safe because if something goes wrong during the firmware update flashing process, the pacemaker's going to stop working. So you need to actually go on to the bypass system before you use the system.
Can we make a movie about the pacemaker? Network upgrades, you don't have to come in to get a firmware upgrade.
Then someone can hack the computer.
My refrigerator's
going to
update.
But that's the concern, though. So the bug in these things was that you can, just if you're near enough to the person, you can send signals to them and you can firmware update them. That was actually the problem.
A little while ago, there was a talk about keyboard vulnerability, and the one that I remember from about a year or so ago had to do with certain keyboards had certain chips in them that would communicate with a wireless keyboard, even though that wasn't a feature that was advertised and people knew was available to these keyboards. Somebody close by could connect to that keyboard, and then with a few keystrokes could format your hard drive.
Pizza's arrived. Shall we migrate?
Yeah. Woo!
Everyone know where we're going?
Yeah.
We'll pick up the question. Let me see. Go ahead, ask the question. Give us something to think about.
Is it Hilton 4.9/208?
Actually, 208/209. Yeah, if we go to the 400, we're going to be walking into tech ops going, where's the pizza?
Well, you should at least say the room out loud and not just be like, hey, we're going to go.
It's at the Sheraton pool.